This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service. I'm Shani Rosenbaum, your host and program manager at Olam. If you tend to get squeamish when conversations take a financial turn, you may want to take a deep breath. On today's episode, we're taking a deep dive into wealth and poverty. When it comes to money, we're living a unique moment. About 1.2 billion people live in extreme poverty around the world. That means living under $1.25 a day. At the other end of the spectrum, about a billion people in our world today live in unprecedented affluence. One recent report indicates that half the world's wealth lies in the hands of just 1% of the world's population. So where do we as Jews fit into this picture? Where is the place of the Jewish people within the broader conversation of how wealth is and should be distributed in the modern world? Joining us today for this discussion are Rabbi Daniel Landes, director of the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies, and Diana Ginsberg, executive director of Olam. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I want to start us off in this kind of enormous topic by zooming into our individual lives within the Jewish communal framework. And so I want to ask you both, growing up in the Jewish community, what was your understanding of the Jewish people's place within the global schema of poverty and wealth? And particularly, what was the understanding of your own communities and your own family's place within the conversation about wealth and poverty?
I grew up in the 1980s in a squarely middle-class neighborhood in Long Island. I didn't really think much about wealth or poverty for most of my childhood. The neighborhood that I grew up in was one that was mostly populated by Italian Catholics and Irish Catholics. The Jews were in the minority. And it wasn't until at the age of 12, we moved to a different neighborhood in Long Island in the Five Towns, that I became aware of wealth almost overnight. I had noticed that there were people who were doing things that up until that point in time had seemed luxury to me, going out to eat regularly in kosher restaurants, going on fancy vacations, having multiple cars and nice houses. And it was something that I instinctively did not feel comfortable with. And my parents, both of whom worked full-time and were full-time parents, brought in a cleaning person to come once every other week. And I remember being so embarrassed of that, feeling that there was something amiss, that I actually lied to friends. The irony of that is that those were friends who had live-in full-time housekeepers. And yet that move from not really being aware of wealth or poverty in one direction or another to being aware of a very well-off Jewish community was very stark for me.
So your reminiscences brings me back to the south side of Chicago, where this Jewish community, a vibrant Jewish community, lived right next door, often on the same block, with a very poor black community. It was in transition. No one knew which way things would go. And the poverty of the blacks in many ways reminded the Jews of old-time desperate situations. And they were also afraid of the black community, afraid of their need, and that there's not much one could do for. There were all sorts of good stories as well, but I would say they lived in fear of the black community, lived in fear of that poverty.
I'm curious for both of you, because what you're beginning to describe is something of a transition that the Jewish community sort of has gone through over the last maybe century, from relative poverty or relative struggle or sort of being on the up and coming to being in a position of relative affluence. Now, it's worth backing up there for a moment and recognizing that it's actually quite challenging to come up with data or statistics around the Jewish community's affluence in the modern world today. I don't suggest that you go to Google and type in Jewish wealth. May or may not have tried that experiment. But one of the indicators we might have about this is the fact that if you look, for example, at the Forbes 400, in the top 100 of the Forbes 400, there are 30 Jews, which means that in some capacity, when we think about the global distribution of poverty. We think about that 1% holding half of the world's wealth, and there being an enormous number of people living in extreme poverty today, that the Jewish community tends to fall along the lines of we're doing okay in the modern day. First of all, how do you all assess that assessment? How does that land with you in terms of where the Jewish community is situated? And how are we weathering that transition?
First of all, I greet some of this with the wealth part. I greet some of this with a cautious joy. We have opportunities. Jews have fulfilled those opportunities. I'm sure there must be some scallywags and scoundrels amongst them. But having money per se is not negative in terms of the Jewish tradition. We don't extol poverty. And whether you're rich or poor, it's good to have dough, as my mother used to say to me when growing up. Never understood that mother's Zen cone, but I kind of understand it now. You know. So, but then the question is, Jewishly, is what do you do with the money? And that, I think, is exactly the case. I think there was a period of time and when the mere fact of Jews doing well became, for the Jewish community, became a self-justifying goal. We're doing well. That means we can survive. But at this point, we have a much more sophisticated notion that survival has to be for a purpose. And that's really how we have to judge. Amongst those people are a great deal of very public and very positive philanthropists. That's something I think we need to leverage more, especially in those who are not giving the money. You know, it's a few non-Jewish billionaires who have led the charge to give away a good part of their money. And that is something for Jews to take a look at.
I think it's important to mention that, yes, there are Jews who live in poverty, and that is something that the Jewish community almost as a backlash to conversations about privilege and power has pointed out in recent studies. If you look at the New York population study, et cetera, there are Jews living in poverty around the world, whether we're talking about people who are elderly or immigrant populations or ultra-Orthodox communities and others. And so that's important to make that point. But I think one of the things that's interesting in this particular conversation is actually thinking about those Jews who self-identify as being part of the middle class, whether they're on the lower end of that spectrum or the upper end of that spectrum. And I think a lot of the conversations nowadays in terms of those middle class Jews, whether we're talking about in the US, which is where I grew up, or in Israel, which is where I currently live, so much of that conversation is about the high cost of living. In the US, it's about the high cost of living Jewishly for those who are very involved in the Jewish community, the skyrocketing rate of day school tuition and Jewish camps, and all the other parts in terms of living an involved Jewish life. And in Israel, if we think about the social protests that happened in the summer of 2011, a lot of that has to do with people's real lives, that there's a struggle in terms of meeting mortgage payments and making ends meet at the end of the month. And so we have a middle class that a lot of the conversation is about the high cost of living. I think one thing that's important in the context of this conversation that we're having now is that that group is infinitely better off than the billion people that you mentioned earlier who live in extreme poverty under $1.25 a day, and the many more who eke out a living in various parts around the world. And I think one of the things that we need to be having a conversation about that I don't think happens enough is, despite the challenges of living a middle-class life and a middle-class Jewish life, if we take a wide view, what does that look like in comparison to others and our relative wealth and what kinds of responsibility comes alongside that?
I think this is really great. Now, so how does one enter that middle class? It's not just, and it's not only, the amount of money that you have to work with. It comes down to two basic elements that could be universalized, which Jews latched onto, and that is education and jobs. And they latched onto it very early in the American experience. and very early in Israel in terms of the percentage now who are going to college. It made all the difference in the world in 1948 when Israel doubled its size, and then the massive Aliyah that took place in the 70s and 80s from the former USSR. And the thing that made the difference for everyone were jobs and education. That sounds to me like a program, a basic program, in terms of what we need to do with allied countries, in terms of Israel, but certainly with in America, with other groups in which we should have a bonding. There's two areas we're expert in. Those two areas, we could actually offer a lot. And not only that, we have a moral demand to offer that.
It's interesting. I recently participated in a gathering where the head of the Senate of Liberia came to Israel and made a very impassioned plea saying to Israel, "You are the people of the book. Help us with our education system, which was in bad shape pre-Ebola and is in much worse shape now. You know this. We need this help." And it was interesting to hear that not as a top-down assessment on the part of the Jewish community or Israelis in terms of our own skill set, but of a need that was articulated by somebody who looks towards Israel and the Jewish people as being experts in this regard.
And this could lead to a real transformation of the Jewish position within the world. We have all sorts of problems. You could have a million sessions on all the different problems. But Jews have a need, a moral command, but also I think an inner need. Human beings have it, but I think Jews are also human beings, to give. And this is an area that we can be quite effective. We can move out of our isolation. We have all the young people who are now serving in Africa, in human aid efforts, education efforts, and in South America and other parts of the world have the highest level of education. They understand this. If you're listening to me, you know what I'm talking about. And you will have your jobs afterwards, and whether or not you put this experience on the resume. But this should now start becoming a universal Jewish experience. Where are you spending your year or 2 years in bringing education and bringing forms of development to other parts of the world? We should be our own human rights, but not just human rights, but human aid effort. I have to say, moderator, I applaud what you're doing. I think what you're doing is great.
Thank you. Something I really appreciate about what you're both sharing is that we're expanding the conversation about wealth and poverty beyond money. That wealth and poverty is not just about who has money, but also who has resources. And that global resources aren't necessarily things we can hold in our hands, but like Rabbi Landy's education, right? Like drip irrigation, which is something that Israel has been sharing, or other agricultural tools with developing nations, that we have at our fingertips a wealth of resources that we can share as well as wealth in terms of cash. And that's something that we should be considering as well in this conversation as we think about what it is we have to offer.
Well, in a very practical sense, I had a student who only studied with me at Pardes for a couple of weeks, and I bumped into him recently, and he was back from really a part of Tibet. And when he returned, he says, "You know, I picked up one thing from the lecture that you gave." Okay, one thing, that's pretty good. What is it? And he knew the three words in Hebrew, "Bipnei seva takum," before the elders stand up. He says, "I put that into action," because I explained in the class that even the rabbis said this refers not only standing up for a Jewish elder, but for even an elder who was a idolater, because they bear within them knowledge. He said, I did it, and it changed my whole standing within the community. People saw that I gave honor to those who deserve honor, the notion of human dignity, and I learned a heck of a lot from them. I said, well, some of us old people have something to give. We have some of those things within us that we're able to do. I will mention just one other notion, that the whole micro-lending programs, which have sometimes their ups and downs, but have overall tremendous ups. Jewish tradition invented that. Small loans, direct loans, no interest loans, demand on repayments, because that's part of human dignity. We've done that within our own communities for 2,000 years. If we expand that outside of ourselves, therefore, you don't have to be a billionaire to be a microlender.
This is Global Torah. I'm Shani Rosenbaum. You're listening to Rabbi Daniel Landes, director of the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies, in conversation with Diana Ginsberg, executive director of Olam. You've both articulated some real aspirations for where the Jewish community could go in terms of what it means to share our wealth, both our wealth in terms of money, our wealth in terms of resources. How do we get there? And particularly what I'm interested in is, does our tradition offer tools that we can utilize to kind of mobilize the Jewish community in the direction of giving more, thinking globally in terms of where we can thread the wealth of our resources?
One initiative that I was part of over the past 2 years or so is an initiative that both came out of Israel and also Jewish communities around the world to revitalize the ancient notion of the sabbatical or Shemitah year, which says that similar to the Sabbath that happens once every 7 days, where there is an opportunity to take stock, to reevaluate our relationship to each other and also to the divine, that there's also an opportunity once every 7 years to take stock, take pause, and to reevaluate our relationship to our economic system, to the land and the environment, to each other. And this has been a fascinating journey, an attempt to take a notion that was really intended for a society that was largely agrarian, which is no longer the case for most of the societies where Jewish people live nowadays, and to see whether we could crystallize some of those basic notions related to debt relief, related to climate change, related to taking stock in terms of dangerous economic trends, and whether there's a way to translate that to the modern world. And over the last 2 years, and last year being the sabbatical year, there have been an emergence of interesting initiatives coming out of Jewish communities around the world to actually try and breathe new life into this ancient idea. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is that in so many circles that I had traveled up until now, where it wasn't clear what the relationship between Jewish tradition, the environment, economic policy, and social change is or was, once there was this conceptual frame of Shemitah, of the sabbatical year, which has rich textual traditions dating back from the Bible and then through modern times, it gave an anchor for conversations and for visioning. The types of visioning processes that I've been a part of as a result were astounding. And I think that that is a value system and a conceptual frame that is unique and has sprung up various social change movements, including several years back, an attempt to revitalize the notion of the Jubilee year, et cetera, which was not coming out of the Jewish community.
I love everything you said. I think that our teachers, in many ways, hold on to your hats, those of you who are listening to me, if you're working in Ghana or if you're working in Guatemala, and you might not think that you have anything left from the Sunday school you attended. But when you will look at Jewish tradition, you will find all sorts of mechanisms that need to be reopened, reclaimed, blown up in the most positive way, and you'll be able to teach the rest of us. I think the notion of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the, just being a presence and visiting the sick, which now is outsourced either to rabbis or to a Mother Teresa type, but it actually is an obligation to everyone. I have a feeling if you go right now into the Zika wards where pregnant women are scared stiff about the babies that they are carrying, this will change your full knowledge of what this ancient ritual can mean, and you'll teach us about it. The whole notion, major Jewish practice of hachnasat orchim, of welcoming visitors, which does not refer to your social friends from your sorority or fraternity, but only means people in need, people that don't have a place, will change our notion of how we relate to migrants everywhere. I think it actually how you can help us, and this is kind of a plea and a command, is a way to open up these Jewish rituals and to use them to build our human capacity for moral action, which is also spiritual action. The rituals should not be ritualized. The rituals should come alive. We're supposed to invite people to our tables who don't have anything to eat, not just on Passover, but on actually every Sabbath meal and on the festivals. We can find ways to do this.
Rabbi Landes, you, in your remarks right now, mentioned the term command several times. And I think that that's really interesting because one of the things that for me is very profound about the Jewish notion of tzedakah is that it's actually an obligation. What's mistranslated as charity, the obligation to give philanthropically is not just something that you do because you're a good person or that you do from a voluntary standpoint, although there are parts of that within Jewish tradition. But the notion that this is a deeply rooted moral obligation is one that I think is really profound. And one of the questions that I have is, for much of the Jewish community today who does not see themselves bound by a system of halakha and Jewish law, is there still a way to translate that notion of tzedakah, of opening your house to the stranger, of visiting the sick as an obligation, not just as you're a nice guy, but this is part of what it means to be a Jew and a human being? I think that's a really interesting question.
It is a good question. A contemporary Jewish philosopher died about 15 years ago, Emmanuel Levinas, great philosopher in France, recognizes one of the great continental world Jewish world philosophers, happened to be an observant Jew. I shouldn't say happened. I think it informs his philosophical discourse. Talk about what's the commanding presence today. You know, we all want our autonomy. But what's the commanding presence that overrides our autonomous selfishness often? And he talked about the face of the other. The face of the other. And here he's really connecting with Maimonides. Maimonides says the worst thing you can do if you offer someone a coin is not to look them in the face. You look them deeply in the face. You look them deeply in the face, you're going to see yourself. You look them deeply in the face. If you don't have a coin, you give them a word. In other words, you have to have that engagement. And so I say is that we've been sheltering our eyes from seeing the pain of the world. It's painful to go into a hospital ward. It's not simple to begin with. It's painful to invite people that you don't know into your house. But let me just assure you, the pain doesn't last long. For some mysterious reason, joy unfolds. You're able to do something. You're able to share. You're going to learn a lot more than you ever thought, and you're going to get a lot more back. We're in a transformational period of opening up our Torah, opening ourselves to the world, and being in the position of giving. It will mean a lot more than whatever small amounts of money alone that we give. I'm for the money giving, but that it will open us up.
I want to focus in the short time we have left together on that notion of looking the needy in the face, to seeing the face of need. I think that our tradition is rich with, like you mentioned, Passover ritual where we open our door and we invite the needy into our homes, that we have a strong tradition of being able to look in the face of need that feels very close. When we think about particularly extreme poverty on the global scale, most of us within the Jewish community aren't necessarily going to have the opportunity to go to Ghana and visit a hospital, right? Or to go to Nepal and sort of see with our own eyes and smell with our own smells, right? that really experience firsthand what the need looks and feels like and look that in the face and the eye. So what is it that we can do within our communities to awaken ourselves to that need to, like you said, keep our eyes open?
One very concrete way of doing that on an individual level, not necessarily on a communal level. We are all consumers of news, and we choose to read headlines that we want to read, and we choose to ignore headlines that we don't want to read. And I think that a practical way of opening up our eyes to that pain is to make a conscious decision. I am going to read headlines that I normally skip over. And I am going to open my eyes and my heart up to that suffering. I think that is a very concrete decision that people can make. I will make sure to open up those headlines as well. One other concrete example is when we think about global issues, I think we always think about things that are really far away. But we have walking windows into that world all around us. Most Jewish institutions, most workplaces, most universities around the world have cleaning staff, have people that we are interacting with on a day-to-day level, many of whom have very challenging life stories, who are minorities, who are immigrants, some of whom may be refugees, who are windows into a world that may be far away geographically, but is actually very close because they inhabit the same physical space that we do. And I think engaging with the people who are in our immediate Dalet Amot, in our immediate four cubits, and seeing them for who they are and getting that larger context of where they've come from is a way to bridge that gap to things that seem very far away.
Well, I say amen. I think short, intensive, by short I mean it doesn't have to take your full work week, but in short, intensive ways of doing good for the people that come to you, they themselves can open you up to what's happening in their world. And I want to bring something from a holiday coming up. We have this holiday of Purim coming up. Humantashen, I don't have to tell you about them. My mouth is watering right now. But one of the things you're supposed to do on Purim as an example, I think it's a very important thing, is you're supposed to give matanot lev yonim, gifts to the poor, which usually refers to monetary gifts. And I say, why did this become? It's already in the scroll of Esther that took place. Because when you have a sudden turn towards affluence and a certain turn to your status, you must take other people with you and help bring them up. And also, I think it's not just doing something good, which it is, but it's also a very smart, strategic move. You can't allow people who will look at your sudden affluence and feel, why are you? You bring them with you. You bring them to the degree that you can bring them with you. And there are a multitude of ways all of us in our lives can bring other people with us, and we have to start doing it.
So to wrap up our time together, if I'm an average Jewish person living in Boston or Tel Aviv, I'm feeling kind of overwhelmed by the massiveness of global poverty and where my place could be in it. Where should I start in thinking about doing my part in addressing those gaps?
First thing I would do is to bring one of the young people that you know of who has come back from one of these experiences in Africa, elsewhere, in Asia, and have them speak about their experience. And ask them the question, what's a small concrete thing we can do, I can do, or we can do, our synagogue can do, this federation, that we can do to make that school that you worked in, to make that water project you worked in, something that we can do. We have our other concerns, but what can we do? Here's the Jewish position. Mitzvah goreret mitzvah. You do one mitzvah, you do one proper righteous act, you know what? It'll propel you to the next one. I'm very optimistic on this.
I think one concrete thing people can do is to give of their funds and to give of their tzedakah money. Peter Singer, the moral philosopher, in his book, In the Life You Can Save, makes a very cogent case for why middle-class people, particularly in America, can and should be giving 5%, which is less than the 10% in Jewish tradition, 5% of their income to help people who live in extreme poverty around the world. And he devotes an entire book to that subject. But for me, the strongest argument he makes graces the first page, in which he says, if you are reading this book, or I would say if you're listening to this podcast, and in your hand is a bottle of water, when you have free and abundant tap water that only costs pennies, but you spent $1.75, then you today have spent more money on your bottle of water that you did not need than a billion people around the world make every day. And by giving that kind of money, small amounts of money go a very long way in that regard. And I think for most of us in the Jewish community nowadays, we spend money on things like bottles of water that we don't give a second thought to that. But that kind of money can mean the world to somebody else.
Thank you so much both for your time and for your insight. It's been a pleasure having this conversation with you.
Shalom, shalom.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for upcoming episodes featuring Rabbi Micha Odenheimer, Rabbi Ruth Gan Kagan, and more. Global Torah is made possible through a partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks to Rabbi Dr. Mishhammer Kassoy, Diana Ginsberg, Louise Scherb, Ben Wallach, and Seth Samuel, and of course, to Rabbi Daniel Landes for joining us today. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. You can learn more and hear this episode again at pardes.org.il and at olamtogether.org.